Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. At Beth Emanuel, we teach Messianic Judaism for all nations. If you find these teachings helpful, please share them with your friends and family. Help us advance the teachings of the kingdom, and remember to support Beth Emanuel with your prayers and financial gifts.
In this series of sermons, we are making some forays into the world of souls, the world of truth, or to say it another way, the unseen world. In order to answer this question, what happens when you die? We're going to be peeking through the lattice that separates our world from the unseen world. And we're going to do it through the stories in the Bible and the teachings in the Bible, of course, through anecdotes and teachings from rabbinic literature, and through the experiences of those who actually have crossed over the threshold and returned. I've already taught on heaven and hell in the teaching series we did at Sukkot several years ago titled, What About Heaven and Hell? And that's still available from First Fruits of Zion. So if you're looking for a quick overview of the eschatology, it's sort of an eschatological rundown with emphasis on establishing a Messianic Jewish view of heaven and hell, that's still available from First Fruits of Zion. But I want to go deeper into the question of the state of the soul after death and see if we can't get a little bit closer to answering this question. What happens to you when you die? I don't mean what happens to your body. We all know about that. We commit the body to the ground, and we know that in the future to come, God will resurrect the body from the dead, just as he resurrected the body of our blessed Master and Savior. This is one of the 13 principles of Jewish faith. In fact, it's number 13. I believe with perfect faith that there will be a resurrection of the dead at the time when it shall please the Creator, blessed be his name, and his mention shall be exalted forever and ever. This is like the conversation we read about in the Gospels when the Master said to Martha, your brother will rise again. And she replied, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. So I'm not asking if there is life after death. I'm not asking about the resurrection of the last day. I'm not asking about the kingdom or the world to come even. I'm not asking about your physical body. I'm asking about you, the person that is you inside your body, the real sense of self behind your mind, your neshama, your spirit. What happens when you die? We know that in the future, your spirit will be returned to your body, as we say in the morning blessings. The soul you placed within me is pure. You created it, you formed it, you breathed it into me, and you protect it within me, and you will ultimately remove it from me, only to return it to me in the future to come. But what happens between the time when you leave your body and the time that you return? That's the question that I'm asking you. And if you think about it, it's a question that should weigh heavily on all of us, since it's inevitable that we are all going to eventually find out the answer. Not only that, but we wonder about our loved ones and those who have gone on without us, who have already left the body, who have already traveled through the veil, who have already entered the world of truth, have already entered the world of souls. You might even say that this is the most important question that faces the human species. It's also the oldest question facing the human species. The meaning of life is all wrapped up in this question. So what could be a more significant question for us to study, to think about? And the answer is not as straightforward as you might think. I mean, what does the Bible teach about it? Well, the Bible isn't really completely clear. There's some seeming contradictions. I mean, you could read some of the Psalms or the book of Ecclesiastes and come to the conclusion that there is no life beyond this one. Even when reading passages which do speak of the afterlife, it's not all completely clear. It's pretty murky. And that murkiness makes room for disagreements and room for uncertainty. Uncertainty, not knowing what's going to happen, that creates fear. And we fear death because it's the big unknown. So let's see if we can do something about that. What does Judaism teach about the state of the dead? What do we know? A lot of Jewish people are actually under the mistaken impression that Judaism doesn't teach any concept of an afterlife. I'll tell you a story. Once I was teaching at Kehilat Sar Shalom, and this young guy who was attending there, it's a Messianic Jewish congregation, this young guy who was attending there brought his Jewish girlfriend to check it out, and she was not a Yeshua follower. Instead, she had grown up in a conservative synagogue in St. Paul or Minneapolis, and it so happened that on that Shabbat, I was teaching about the Master's parable of the rich man and Lazarus. The latter character ends up in Gan Eden, the former ends up in Gehenna. And so I was, of course, speaking about the afterlife and heaven and hell. And all through the teaching, this woman's eyes were burning into me. And I thought, wow, this girl's really, she's taking this pretty seriously. And afterwards, her boyfriend told me that the whole time that I was teaching, his girlfriend wanted to kill me, or at least slap me. And I asked him why. And he said, because she says you are a liar. She says that Jews don't believe in heaven or hell. That's what her rabbi told her. So this reaction didn't really actually surprise me at all, because Reform and Conservative Judaism don't believe a lot of things that Judaism teaches. That's why they're called Reform and Conservative, because they aren't straight Judaism. They are watered down by the Enlightenment. Retrofitted for the modern era, reconfigured for compatibility with a secular materialist worldview, with all the supernatural stuff taken out. But I assure you, the New Testament writers did not say anything or teach anything about the afterlife or about the state of the soul that was not already a part of Jewish teaching, at least the teaching of the Pharisees. And that's an important point. The New Testament reveals no new information about the afterlife and the state of the soul that was not already known and taught among the Pharisees. What the New Testament does is that it comes and it resolves some unanswered questions, settling a few debates, like the question of whether only the righteous are resurrected or if everyone is resurrected, and issues like that. But otherwise, the New Testament assumes the spiritual afterlife views of Pharisaic Judaism. As it says in Acts 23:8, for the Sadducees say there is no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. Josephus tells us, the Pharisees believed, quote, that souls have an immortal rigor in them, and that under the earth, meaning after death, there will be rewards or punishments according as they have lived virtuously or viciously in this life. And the latter are to be detained in an everlasting prison, but that the former shall have power to revive and live again. And the Mishnah and the Talmud and the Midrash and all the authoritative texts of Judaism teach the existence of the soul, reward and punishment in the afterlife, Gehenna and Gan Eden, and ultimately a resurrection of the dead. There's a lot of material in Jewish texts on this subject. And in fact, it's a vast wealth of material. It's central. It's a central belief in Judaism, not necessarily in Reform, not in conservative Judaism, but in real Judaism. It's not a question. There is also this family that attended Sar Shalom from the Worldwide Church of God. And that guy also was angry with me for teaching about the undying soul and the state of the dead and immediate survival after death. In his church, which is similar to Seventh-day Adventist tradition, they interpret the statements in the Psalms about how the dead know nothing and the dead do not praise you, nor do those who go down to the grave, and these types of statements in the Psalms to mean that there is no spirit or soul, not in the conventional way that we understand it, which is to say there's no survival of consciousness, no survival of the individual after death. Some call it soul sleep. The idea is that once you die, you're dead until the resurrection. And there's nothing else. No awareness, no consciousness, no ghost, so to speak. The screen goes blank, shuts down, unplugged, lights out. This view is like what we read in the book of Ecclesiastes, where it says in Ecclesiastes 3:19-21, for what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from dust, and to dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? So this guy was really angry with me too. This fellow actually couldn't get over it. He stalked me for years, even after leaving the congregation, and harassed me and defamed me and agitated against me and distributed literature against me for years because I taught the ongoing conscious existence of the soul after death. I taught survival. But I would tell him, look, I'm just teaching what the New Testament says and what Judaism says. Well, actually, he had other complaints about Judaism and Jewish teaching, too. So he advocated alternate calendars, he hated the rabbis, and so forth, which makes you wonder why such a person would attend a Messianic Jewish synagogue. But anyway, so I guess what I'm saying is that this is a dangerous question to pose. It's not necessarily safe territory to go poking around behind the veil because it makes people uncomfortable. It might make people really angry, especially if they don't get the answer that they want to hear. I mean, this is hallowed ground. But you know what they say about fools. We rush in where angels fear to tread. So, this time, we're rushing in where actually angels do tread. The world of souls, an unseen world, unseen from our side of it. There are those who say things like, seeing is believing, or I'll believe it when I see it. But that's a scientifically unreasonable position to occupy. Do we really think that unless we can see or perceive something, it doesn't exist? If I can't see it with these ridiculous gelatinous orbs in my skull, with eyes designed to perceive only a tiny fraction of the EM spectrum, then it doesn't exist? Do you see gamma rays? What do they look like? What color are they? Do you see X-rays? What does dark matter look like? It's perhaps the most abundant substance in the universe, but has anyone at any time ever seen a speck of it? Once it happened that Elisha the prophet and his servant were being hunted by the Syrian army, and the king of Syria sent an army of horses, chariots, and soldiers to surround the city of Dothan. And Elisha's servant got up early in the morning just as the sun is rising, and he stretches and goes outside the house, and he's walking along the wall, and he sees that the entire city is surrounded by the Syrian army. And the servant said, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" And Elisha said, "Do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And then Elisha prayed and said, "O Lord, please open his eyes that he may see." So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. The spiritual world, the unseen world, the world of souls, is not exactly a different world than this one. It's not a different universe. It's a different level of perception of the world, a world of spirit instead of physical energy and matter. According to the mystics who occupy themselves with these types of questions, there are four worlds, not four planets, and not even necessarily four different places, but four levels, so to speak. Our world is the lowest of these. It's called Asiya, the world of action. But it also encompasses the spiritual. Asiya, the world of action, has two sides, the spiritual and the physical. Above this world, one might say, behind this world, are ascending realities that span the distance from here to Hashem. The divine light emanates from the world of Atzilut, the world of emanation, and it creates out of nothing in the world of Berea, the world of creation, and takes shape and form in Yetzirah, the world of formation, finally moving into the sequence of cause and effect that we recognize as Asiya, our world, the world of action. Or, alternatively, the Talmud speaks of seven heavens, Vilon, Rakia, Shechakim, Zebul, Ma'on, Machon, and the seventh heaven where the Ophanim and the Seraphim and the Chayot and the throne of the Lord are located, Arabot. Under ordinary circumstances, these things, these realities, are unseen, undetected by human beings, just like you can't hear the pitch of a dog whistle, but the dog can. We can't see these realities, nor can we see the spiritual entities that occupy them. angels, archangels, demons, spirits. We only see the physical, but without the spiritual behind the physical world would not even exist, could not exist. It would be an emptiness. The Talmud says that every single blade of grass is assigned an angel that tells it to grow, which only means that the physical world is completely infused with an unseen spiritual component. So here's a fair question. If we can't see it, if we can't feel it, if we can't experience it, if we can't smell it or hear it or taste it, and there's no math equation that we can do to prove its existence, how do we know that this spiritual world exists at all other than in a mental construct? Is it just superstition? Are we supposed to just believe it because someone said so? Because it's dogma and therefore it must be true? Not at all. That's not how our faith works. The Bible says that every matter must be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. We know that the spiritual world exists, and that God exists for that matter, because we have received credible testimony from reliable witnesses. You see, occasionally the veil lifts. Occasionally there is a glitch in the matrix or an intentional revelation where God opens our spiritual eyes to see what ordinarily cannot be seen, as he did for Elisha's servant. And we have received testimony from witnesses who have seen into the other world. That testimony is the testimony of the Bible. Writings left behind by men and women of immense integrity, the prophets and the apostles. These were not credulous fools passing on Hebrew superstitions. These were sober-minded, literate men and women who had astonishing experiences with the unseen world and became witnesses to the supernatural. And they have left us their testimony, which is this book, the Bible. Our faith rests on their eyewitness testimony, the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Hebrews 11 creates a list of witnesses, a great cloud of witnesses. And it's on the strength of their testimony that we believe. And it's not just them. Others have had these types of experiences with the supernatural. People have crossed over from this world to the world of souls and reported back. It's not that uncommon. In fact, thanks to modern medical practices, it's become increasingly common since the 1960s and the introduction of modern methods of resuscitation. But people have been reporting what's called near-death experiences, NDEs, for as long as human beings have been coming near to death. I'll tell you one. This is from the Talmud. Rabbi Yosef, the son of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, became ill and fell into a trance or into a deep sleep. When he recovered, his father asked him, "What did you see?" "I saw an upside-down world," he replied, "where those on top are underneath, and those underneath are on top." Rabbi Yehoshua said, "My son, you saw the true world." In the world of truth, the things that seem important and prestigious here in this world are regarded of little or of no value, whereas things that would be dismissed as insignificant in this world are regarded to be of enormous value in the spiritual world. The true value of things is revealed in the world of truth. Celebrities and powerful people, the wealthy and privileged, people of rank and prestige, find that in the world of truth, they are regarded as insignificant. Whereas people who might seem insignificant on this side of reality turn out to be first in rank. This inversion of values holds true not just in the world of souls, but also in the kingdom and in the world to come. This is what our master means when he says, "The first will be last, the last will be first." In the world of truth, the values are reversed. The Israeli boy, the Nathan, the boy who had the near-death experience during the Festival of Sukkot a few years ago, reported the same astonishing reversal of values. He was astonished at how the smallest sins he had committed, the most insignificant sins, were considered a big deal. And he was surprised how the smallest mitzvah he had done, the most insignificant mitzvah, was considered to be of such enormous significance. So great that you did this mitzvah, such a huge thing. And when he saw the real value of the mitzvah, he wanted to return in order to perform more. Things that are important here are not important in the world of souls. In this world, money is the important thing. Without money, you've got nothing. We spend most of our lives in pursuit of money, working for money, serving mammon, right? But in the world of souls, and ultimately in the world to come, our money doesn't have any value. In the world of souls, the currency is mitzvot. So our master Yeshua teaches us that you have to switch out the currency before you arrive there. It's like every time when I go to Israel, the first thing I have to do is convert my dollars into shekels, because the dollars don't work in Israel. Likewise, money doesn't work in the world of souls. You need to exchange them for mitzvot before you leave. And this is what Yeshua means when he says, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into eternal dwellings. In the world of souls, the three-dimensional world of length, height, and width, of occupying space and being in only one place at one time, the limitations of physicality, all of that with which we are familiar and we consider to be real, all of that becomes irrelevant. The regular rules of space and time do not apply. Yet despite that, the world of souls is not an unreal, shadowy, shifting place of mist and transparency and insubstantiality. That's the way it might look when glimpsed from over here. But from the perspective of the world of souls, this world is the one that looks artificial, like a low-res Atari video game on a little black and white TV compared with today's best fluid graphic CG animation on a high-definition, full-color flat screen, more real than real. I mean, just no comparison. We learned about this when we studied the apocalypses, what Ezekiel saw, what Daniel saw, what Isaiah saw, what John saw. They didn't have words to describe the things they saw, the things they experienced. They could only speak in similes and parables. It was like this, they said. It was like that. I saw what looked like. I heard what sounded like. The voice of one speaking. Because human language does not contain the vocabulary necessary to express the spiritual world or to describe the experience of crossing over there. But from all reports, the world of souls is a world of beauty. I mean, so much so, if you saw it or experienced it, you probably wouldn't want to leave it. You probably would lose interest in this life, and we don't want that. We have a mitzvah that says, choose life. There's nothing wrong with having a fear of dying. You don't want to die, but there's no reason to fear death. Do you see the difference? Fear of death is slavery to this world. If I believed that this world is all that there is, I would be afraid of death too. And I'd be a slave to this world. Eat, drink, be merry. Tomorrow we die. That's materialism. The materialist reductionist worldview that we are just animals and we die like animals, and when we die, that's it. That's lifelong slavery. But the Son of God sets us free from slavery to the material world, and he reveals to us that death is not the end. In the book of Hebrews, the exhorter says, Yeshua himself partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. So Paul tells us that the disciples of Yeshua are to be of good courage, because we don't fear death. Because we know that to be away from the body is to be at home with the Master. And we would rather be at home with the Master. But whether we are at home or away, he says, we make it our aim to please him. So what happens when you die? I will tell you. Your soul leaves your body and transitions into the world of souls, no longer seeing with physical eyes. The spiritual world that is all around us comes suddenly into view, a world of spirits and angels, and the souls of those who have gone on before us, a world that is more real than our own, more substantial than this one, a true world, an upside-down world, into which the disciple of Yeshua who clings to him will be welcomed to the place of reward. It is into this world that we will be peering as we continue to learn about the world of souls.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.